identifications. It's MP SM 12, an interview with Millicent Chalmers on the 17th of September at Miller's Point with Siobhan McHugh. Side A.
Yeah.
But she was like a lot of those characters who are reformers or leaders, that they're not necessarily attractive. She could be very funny and very witty and charming. She could also be very abrasive. But she was one of those black and white characters. But she did a lot of good. And that was the thing that I respected. And she worked really hard.
So how long then did Shirley Ball... was she healthy up to the end of her life if she was so active? You said she was still in the Resident Action Group.
Well, she was healthy in the sense that she was she got around. She had a sore back and hips and knees for years and years, but she lived in a four-story house. She coped. I took her shopping every Saturday, unless I was away, for 10 years, say. And she became increasingly stiff. Of course, mind you, she'd led a hard life in the sense that she was She had the house that she lived in, the museum, and she had a boarding house down here. And she did for a long time, she did the cleaning. Her husband, she was married to a chap called Harry. Harry came from Leicester in England. He insisted on her helping him move the furniture up and down when people moved and things. Now, she used to say that moving the fridges, you know, her helping him move the fridges and things up and down in the houses and all, because the boarding house down there had kitchens in some of the areas. It wasn't a boarding house of the sense of one person cooking for everyone. People had their own kitchens. They shared the bathrooms. But, you know, Harry did. That was terrible. And he insisted. And her back was bad right to the end. Terrible.
Did she have any children?
Yes. A son and a daughter. Neil and Belinda.
Have they kept up a connection with the Point?
No. Mm. No, that's the same story.
Mm. Well, Millicent, just moving to when you came in to live here, just taking you back to that, to your personal story of coming in here in 1990, can you describe again, can you just walk me through the house as you found it here at Fort Street, and then what you did to it over those 9 months of getting it habitable?
Oh, well, as I say, it had been squatted in. People had urinated all through the carpet in there and all. It was... What had happened was that the Department of Housing had gone up and down the street taking out the dangerous gas fittings and things to make the houses safer, which was understandable. But what they'd done here, the veranda had threatened to fall off and they replaced the veranda and built the kitchen on, built the bathroom on. Now, there was no kitchen in the house. There'd been a kitchen on the first floor, and there'd been on the top floor a little sink. And there had been a kitchen here on the veranda, and that all fell off into the yard when they started to pull at it. So when we came, the house had no kitchen at all, because it had all been pulled out. Or there were the holes in the plaster where they'd pulled all the dangerous gas pipes out and just left everything as it was. And so we had to start, first of all, weekend after weekend, we would come, and I'd come sometimes after work and do a couple of hours, dragging the rubbish down from the floors. We found things like a shopping trolley, you know, one of the from Woolworths or Coles or whatever, and it had been cut in half across. Strange, why, we could never work out. They were all, you know, it was dreadful. And cartons and boxes and old clothes, and touchingly up on the top floor, some transient person, a man, had left his shaving gear in a little row. They laid out on the floor, but neatly in a row. And I'd got drunk and forgotten where he left it, or died, or whatever, we don't know.
So when Professor Ryan had it, was he not living here then?
He still teaches in the University of New England, and he lived here. He used to come down here and stay when he came down to give tutorials or to work at the Sydney University or whatever, and he had boarders here, and it was a good place to come to, you know, a little stopping off point when he had to come to Sydney. But the department insisted on taking possession, and because he was away, they moved in and took possession of it.
So did they countenance the squatters being here then?
Because it gradually fell into desuetude, and it was during that period that the squatters moved in. It was terrible. And I don't know the story of that. And Professor Ryan didn't know what was going on, so we don't know how that happened.
And you mentioned that he was a bit eccentric, so he wasn't the sort of materialistic type who would be worrying.
Oh, he tries to be businesslike. But the point is, it wasn't so much worrying, it was that the department had possession. And it was only... And the landlady's battle went on in the courts, but things happened in between. And he didn't... It was only at the end that he got the lease for the premises. See, the legal problem stemmed from the fact that when the Maritime Services had it, Maritime Services Board had the area, they didn't have leases. The people had occupancies. And money changed hands for them, but there was no legal documentation of it. It was one of those things, historical things, you know. And so consequently, there was no proper protection until the courts and the landladies' battles in the courts, the landladies won progressively in different courts.
And their cause was upheld on the basis, I believe, of custom and practice. That was the legal term, that the fact that they had had such a tradition of mm-hmm. having the residentials.
Mm-hmm.
So then, what was your arrangement? Did you
I bought a lease. Being a lawyer, you can imagine that I wasn't going to spend thousands and thousands of dollars, because by then I had the money from the house. It wasn't a huge amount, but it was enough to buy the registered lease.
And so what's your position now, can you tell me?
I think that's all. I don't think that's part of the oral history.
Okay, but you were able to buy a lease from the Department of Housing?
No, from Professor Ryan.
From Professor Ryan, but this house is still owned by the Department of Housing?
Always, yes. It was transferred into the name of the Department of Housing back in 1985.
Yes. Mm. Okay, and so did you intend to have boarders yourself?
I did have boarders.
Oh, what were they like?
Oh, well, they were... Because I had two children who were by then both at university, I had in always at least one other university student, and that was compatible. That meant that they got along, they didn't always agree, but at least they were comfortable with one another. And so we had a succession of university students. Particularly one who was the son of a chap that I'd met through the study of lexicography, and he was a shy sort of chap, so that worked out quite well.
And what is the layout? Could you just tell me the structural layout of the house, how many bedrooms, etc.?
Well, it's four stories. There's a bedroom and a sitting room on the top floor, or what used to be three bedrooms, all very, very, very well, one quite a good size and two very tiny ones. The second floor, there's a bedroom at the back, which is just above us here, and a hall along. All across the front is one room now. It was two bedrooms, but it was a very rickety old wall, and it started to get a bit worrying. So we took the wall down because it was quite recent, and the department's quite happy with that, and made that into what is in effect a library, because my sister and I both collect books. And then on this floor we've got our sort of study and the kitchen dining room. Downstairs underneath us is a room much the same as this, which used to be the old kitchen. And that's my bedroom.
Now. So when you had the boarders, did you cook for them, or were they self-sufficient?
No, I cooked for them. They sat at dinner with us. Mm. And it was very different. We'd never had anything like that.
No.
You can imagine, we'd always lived in a house that was just us. But, of course, after the upheaval of Graham, my husband, departing and moving here, the kids said, "Mum, you mean we're going to have a stranger in the house?" And I said to them, "Well, that's the terms of the lease, so we'll abide by it." So we did, and it was good for them.
And how did your children adapt? Your daughter was aghast at first when she saw this place. How did she adapt to living here?
Loved it. But the point is that she had always lived in a house. My husband is still very meticulous and likes everything in its right place. She'd always grown up with everything tidy, and to come into a house that stank with a dark, well, actually a good quality carpet, but it had been badly treated, a dark rich brown carpet about the colour of this polished table all through here because this had been a bed sitter, but of course fearfully abused, and strange colours on the walls and all, and old mattresses with great cuts and rips in them along the hall, and obscene messages on the walls, and it was just awful for her. Well, it was awful for me, but I thought, if we're going to survive, and if we're going to, as a family, so I was working full time. We had to do it, so we did, and it meant getting the place empty. That helped, getting rid of the old. There were some bits of a broken old furniture. Once we'd got rid of those, and then we washed down the walls and washed the floors and ripped up the carpet and took it to the tip. I spent half my life at the tip. We had an old station wagon called Dougal, because it was white and Dougal was the dark one. So that was Dougal. And Marcia has a station wagon again, and he's Dougal too. But we spent our lives filling Dougal up with rubbish and driving off to the tip.
Where is the tip from here?
Over at St. Leonard's, you know, the tarn. So we went and we did that. Well, then it started to feel better. When you had the bare boards and the very cracked and dreadful ceilings. Now, we've just had the ceiling redone and this room painted. And as you can see, there was a huge crack up there. So we've got to paint that. That will take, because it's a heritage
property.
Well, the mending of it there was done by a heritage builder that I know, and he did that in a. It's got two layers because underneath is that's lath and plaster, because the house was built. Well, this terrace was built 1834 to 1836, so you have to be careful of it. And he came, and but we did the boys took, when they first did the ceiling, you know, those big tins of powdered plaster that you used, you know, to mend things, we used a tin on the ceiling
in the kitchen
just here. Yes. Poor old thing.
And apart from the physical, you know, the huge renovations and changes you had to make, you were moving from Roseville, which was presumably quite a middle-class, orderly sort of suburb, into what was still really a very working-class area and inner city. How did you and the children adapt to that or find that?
Well, luckily, for the first 6 months, we were so busy that we didn't have too much time to be worried about it. I was worried that things like the trains would keep everyone awake, and they all knew that they were going to be kept awake. And
because you're literally a stone's throw from the bridge here.
Yes. Well, you see, that was... After 2 weeks, you know, we didn't notice the trains. After all that, the kids drove me mad. And, of course, there were various things that happened. We'd had to move from the house at Roseville because Graham and his lady friend were buying us out. They wanted to move in. And so I rented a house at Chatsworth. And that wasn't very good. So when the house was all painted and carpeted and the lino and all that, the kids became a bit more comfortable about moving in. This was, and of course, before the furniture came in, it looked huge. I mean, it is huge, but it looked even larger. So it started to get to be a bit exciting for them. And of course, it was close to the uni, and, you know, and so that was a great relief. So we had that advantage, which was good. So that we were buoyed up by the novelty of it for a while. We had a couple of bad times. For instance, the first St. Patrick's Day was terrible, because in those days the police allowed people to get a lot drunker than they do now, and there were people unconscious across the Dawes Point Park, and it was hideous. I'd never seen anything like that, of course. So that was frightening. There were a couple of student pub crawls that really upset me. There were some medical students, and they'd been going through the city, and they were drinking at the Harbour View, not with the present owner, the previous owner. And one of the girls fell down unconscious across on the corner. And the rest of them, they're all in there wearing their white medical coats, as was the style of the time. And they walked away down the street. And I'd gone out on the veranda to hear what all the shouting and yelling was. She was just lying there, and they were walking away. Anyway, I tore across the road and called them. And they sort of turned back, and I said, "What about her?" And they laughed, because they were off their face, and said, "She's drunk." And I said, "Well, you get her a cab and get in the cab with her and take her home, or I call the police." So then we had to convince the cab driver to let them into the cab. And I said to them, "You can't leave an unconscious girl out in the middle of, you know, goodness knows what would have happened to her."
And what about the publican? Wasn't the publican interested?
I didn't bother going in, remonstrating with the publican. There was no point. I knew that. That was one of the things that you did learn. So, but that was also something that came up at the Resident Action Group. And the police started to clamp down.
And what about, I'm jumping around a bit, but just wait for this. Oh, it's at 4 o'clock. Mm. What about the interaction you've had over the years, apart from the community, but with tourists? What sort of level of interaction do you have with them?
Well, that's good. It's nice. You know, people ask where things are. One of the things that we find entertaining is that, and my sister and I have travelled quite a bit, is that, and we're both used to using maps, is that they can stand there with the Harbour Bridge and say, "We've come along George Street. Where's Central Railway?" You know, a lot of them don't orient themselves well. They don't think the sun's there, that's the west. There's the bridge over the harbour. Here, Central Railway will be that way. Things like that. But they are, most of them are very cheerful and appreciative. So it's nice. It's good.
Just when I was coming in, there's a big bus across the road, just literally across the road. I mean, does it ever get irritating?
We have difficulties, and one of the things that we have to do is to constantly work with the Sydney Harbour Foreshores Authority and the City Council and the police to see that the coaches leave enough room for the public bus to turn, things like that. And also that they don't sit there. Years ago, they used to, you could have three or four buses, tourist coaches, lined up in the summer, belching out carbon monoxide for an hour while they waited for the tourist. Well, we don't put up with it anymore. We ring the council or the police or the authority to get them to move and park down in Hickson Road or, you know, somewhere where. But that's the thing about the resident action group. There's always something to be worked on.
Well, what sort of people are in the resident action group? What kind of range of people do you have?
Well, the wonderful thing about it is that we have some 80, 85, 90-year-old people who've been working-class people, who've lived here all their lives, whose parents lived here. We've got various people who've moved in who are more on a more professional, educational level. One of the things that we were very wary of was when the high-rise people came, when the flats like the Georgia and the Highgate and so on came in, how it would all work. They've been marvellous. They really have. And so that they're a mixture of retired people, people who've had businesses, property developers, all sorts of people. They're good friends.
And what about the Walsh Bay redevelopment? Has there been much integration of the people there into the community?
That's taking a while because a lot of them haven't moved in that long. But, in fact, I'm just about to do another newsletter to distribute because a lot of them don't know we exist. So it takes a bit of time. That's the next stage of the next group to bring into the community. Darling House has been a good thing for that.
Well, tell me about Darling House, because I know that you were involved. You're on the board of it now. Yeah, yeah. And I know.
Well, I was on the board of it from 1991.
Well, Darling House is an aged care facility just in Trinity Avenue.
Yeah.
And it was a long struggle to get it, wasn't it?
It was, yes. When I came here, the local community had been granted the right to use the derelict house, stone house, that was on the block of land. And they'd managed to get support and for Darling House to be built. I was, you know, a part of the group when we were negotiating about how many. First, we thought we might be able to get 16 units, but we could only get 9 because what happened was the planning requirements changed. And in a way, that has worked out well. And it had been a terrible struggle. I went to one of their jumble sales and got talking, and of course it was part of this thing of joining in. So
do locals get priority placement there?
Well, we try and get the locals to come in, but the locals have been so independent. We've had lots of locals. We've had some marvellous people there, and but now, the point is it's very important to keep it full. So we've had periods when we haven't had anyone local in there, and then other times we've had quite a few. So, but we do try, and because after all, it was basically meant for the locals.
And how is it funded? Is it expensive for somebody local to go there?
Well, what happens is there's several ways you can go in. You can go in with as a pensioner, can go in with government subsidy. But people who have assets, there's an asset test and you put in a bond. Now, the bond goes into an investment. When the person either dies or goes into a nursing home or goes somewhere else, that bond is refunded less an amount, and they pay also a weekly amount. But that also is subsidised by the federal government.
But it must be very important for local people to feel that they can stay in the area as they get older because of the emotional ties.
It is, but you know, this is a group of really sturdy, independent people too. And we've found that they will stay in their flat or wherever they are to the last minute and struggle up and down stairs, totter along to the shop and all. They're wonderful. They really are. They're wonderful. It used to irritate Shirley into the ground, which was very funny, because she'd done all that work, and she had done years of work agitating with the local state government and with the council and with the Commonwealth government and getting the money to have the place built and all of that. Really, really hard work. I drove her around so she could choose, and we went to places where we could get crockery of a good quality but cheaply. And she wanted it with flower patterns and homely things on it, so people didn't feel they were in an institution. It had to all be comfortable and homely. And she went out and chose herself to make sure it was done. There's no business of it'll be all right. And then, of course, people would get to be older and older, and she would think, Nancy will come in. No way. No, Nancy would have trouble getting in and out of the chair and all of that. I'm all right. Part of it, I'm sure, with some of them, was that it was Shirley Ball's darling house, you know. But part of it also is that a lot of them are very strong people. And they came from a period when life wasn't easy, you know. And the things that people take for granted today didn't exist.
Do you ever feel an affinity with the place? Because I understand your grandfather had a maritime link on a clipper going to China.
Well, he was the captain for only a couple of voyages, mind you, of the clipper ship Yalloroy, which came out here from Aberdeen and then on to China, and they'd take wool and tea and, you know, for the Nicholson Line. And he told stories about this area. And there was a lane with, as you can imagine, lined with brothels. And they made a sign and put a nice frame around it and called it Yalloroy Street and put it up, and the girls all thought it was lovely, and they sailed away. So when they came back, another group had painted over Yalloroy Street and had done raised letters of theirs. So the Yalloroy boys thought, right, and by this time, of course, it was well and truly, you know, bolted into the rock. And so they filled it with soap, finished it with oil paint, and it was Yalloroy Street again. Apparently, it was a terrible fight, like a fist fight in the street over it, but Yeah, so it was a funny feeling.
Well, it's interesting, though, that it's come full circle in a way, that you're back here
back
now.
Back here.
Do you feel any sense of romance seeing the big ships coming in and out?
Oh, absolutely. I talk about my sister. My sister, when our mother died, my sister moved in with us. She joined the Navy when she was 18, and she left 30 years later as a captain. So Mars and I will hear the sirens, the ships are going, and we watch them there, and then we walk out to the front and watch them going out. And in the summer afternoons, we sit out the front and can see the ships. Yes. Very, very good. So we feel strongly about that.
Hmm. So how do you feel about what's going to happen next year then when the Patrick site closes? What would you like to see happen?
Well, the Resident Action Group is part of the Working Harvard Coalition. We would very much like to see that stay as an active wharf for two reasons. Well, there's a whole lot of reasons, but we think it's important to keep the harbour with the facility, because we think it's a bit vulnerable, particularly in these uncertain times, to have your sea transport separated out from the city up in Newcastle and down in Port Kembla, because explosions on the road cut you off. And I know that sounds highly dramatic and all that, but it can happen. Or with the weather becoming increasingly uncertain, that's not such a good idea. So we would like to see the deep anchorages. See, that the deepest part of the harbour is over in front of Luna Park. Now, all this area around here has very deep fissures. Now, to get the big ships in to the nice deep anchorage, Grandfather used to say that down at Circular Quay was so shallow that for the big ships, the manoeuvring was awkward, because in shallower water, the ships move more quickly than they do in deep water. But this anchorage ground is excellent.
Where the site is. Just a few things to clear up from before. Who got rid of the squatters when you came in?
Oh, they'd gone. They had... The police had been in, so we gather. We didn't know. And the department also had work done, and they had come in. The workmen had come in and changed the locks. And while we were working and doing things, someone jimmied, opened the doors and stole some fireplaces and all of that. But then we changed the locks and locked it up again, and so it was safer.
And was the veranda closed in when you got it? The veranda?
Yes.
And so in terms of... The big changes, you took down the wall. This is just for the purposes of the architecture, understanding what changes have been made. Mm-hmm. You took down that inside wall. Have you done anything
because
else?
Because it fell. Well, it didn't. It started to creak. And we looked at it and thought, well, we can do one of two things, repair it or get rid of it. So we got rid of it. But it's much as it was. The when they replaced the back veranda was closed in, And they said to us, do you want it closed in again? And we said, well, no, leave it open, because we thought that was better.
So how do you find the Department of Housing now as a landlord?
Oh, I don't think that's a thing to comment on. As you can imagine, as someone, well, Shirley Ball and I wrote a report, a submission to the Department of Housing, and went in and spoke to its director years and years and years ago. Now, as a result of that and various other things, the estate advisory groups were started. There have been times when Shirley and I have had to negotiate with them about various things. And so it's, you know, like dealing with any government department.
What about the resident action group? What would be the main issues that you deal with? You mentioned, the buses and the noise, but what are the other sort of issues that come up that you are in charge of?
Well, what happens? We've got the Sydney Harbour Foreshores Authority have authority up to the Harbour Bridge. The City Council has authority beyond that. Then that's as far as being the authority for approving changes to things and all that. So we negotiate with them about all sorts of things that they're doing and things that need to be doing to be done. We keep in touch with the City Council as far as trees that need to be lopped, dangerous fences and things on the cliff, and of course we've built up a relationship with the Walsh Bay developers, and that took a long time and a lot of work, but it's been well worthwhile. They've become very good supporters of the community, including Darling House.
And what about the social issues? Is crime a problem?
It's better than it was. Much better. It's moved. It depends on who is living in the area. We've had various families from time to time that have been a serious problem. The families have different characteristics. Some of them mug people. Some of them do break and enters. You know, some break into cars. And that changes over the years. We're going through a good patch at the moment. There's less going on. But this, as I say, just depends on who's out of jail. Lee Farrell, who's the girl from the police, who's our local community liaison officer, will say to us, be very careful at home. I can't tell you the name, but we've had someone come out of jail. And you think, I know who that is. Right. Be very, very careful. Lock everything within an inch of its life.
Sounds a bit like Rumpole territory.
Well, it really is like that. I've never thought of that. It's exactly like that. Some families, boys, that's their modus operandi. And James was home studying one time and came down the stairs, and there's this chap taking the money out of his wallet, which was on the sideboard. And luckily James startled him and took the money back from him, and the chap hit him before he left. Mm. But, you know, bizarre.
Well, what sort of people could you, just without necessarily mentioning the names, but could you give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of the people who live in this street? You know, who are they? Single? Are they? What sort of ages? What sort of occupations do they have? You know, what sort of ethnicities?
Starting at the bottom, now you will find that the people who are at home during the day will be able to give you better information than me, because I leave for work at 7:20 and I get home at about 6:30. But if they're still there, in the first house there was a girl who was a solicitor, and I think her parents. There's a house here that's a boarding house, and I know the people to nod to, but I don't know their names, or a number of elderly people. Now, for instance, further up there's Sally Clough and Dawn Fitzroy, both marvellous characters. And Sally's been here. Well, she went all through the Land Ladies of Battle, and she's well worthwhile talking to. Mm. And Dawn came down from somewhere up in the North Shore, and she's wonderful. Then further along is Brian Harrison, whom you really must
interview. He does the ghost trips.
He does the ghost trips, yes.
Yeah.
He's Shirley Ball's nephew.
We've spoken to him.
We've spoken to him. Yeah. Now, then, in one of the houses beyond that is Julie, I can't think of her surname, who was working, so far as I know, at Sydney University. She has a daughter. And also John Bassett, who has one of the boarding houses over here, did have a lease down there. Now, how that arrangement is, I don't know. John is a sound engineer at the Opera House. He also has a feeling for wanting to change the community and all, but he has a more more confrontational than I would prefer. I tend to think we should try and integrate everything and try and all get along together and work together. And he tends not to be quite like that, but everyone has a different view of how things are done. The house after that is let, I think, on a 5A lease. But some of the characters, for instance, in Brian's house is a marvellous character, Bob, who buys and sells bric-a-brac and stuff. But I don't know how long he's been here. But he's a character, very helpful.
I saw somebody with bric-a-brac out the front as I came up Fort Street. I thought it was Norm. It's at a little sign saying Norm's bric-a-brac or something.
Oh, right.
Just a few doors down from you?
Down that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right.
In Milton Terrace somewhere, I think.
Oh. Well, that's interesting. Mm. I must go and have a look. Then on the corner is Geraldine Thomas, and she's been here for many, many years. And she has only just retired from working at the Telegraph, writing all sorts of things, but particularly their cooking series column. She's been here, as I say. She was here through the Landladies' Battle and all, so she would be a good person to interview. House next door is vacant, That was funny. I went in there to look at it because there was a suggestion that they might sell the lease. And then I thought, oh, I'd have a look. Of course, I had no idea how expensive it was going to be, and it was obviously far outside my range. But what was funny was that in the cellar, the flooring had been taken up. It had had wooden flooring. Out the cellar here has concrete. But the flooring had been taken up and the dirt was bare. And it turned out that a lady had lived there who was a Polynesian. And she hated having to always live with these wooden floors, and she wanted a dirt floor, so she took up the floor.
Maybe she had a hungi there, you know, the way the Polynesians, they have...
I wondered about what else was... But luckily, no. It was just that she could walk around in her bare feet with the dirt.
Mm.
Strange.
Takes all kinds.
It does.
But do you think, you mentioned earlier that back in the days of the Battle of the Landladies, that there was a fear that the government was thinking of selling off the houses here, the Neville Rann government, and that really that could have been at the heart of why the landladies fought so hard to hold on to the leases.
Well, yes. No, that they fought because that was their livelihood and this was where they lived.
But also that they lived here and that they didn't want either themselves
to be turfed out.
Or the tenants to be turfed out. So it wasn't about, as some people have said, that they were trying to make a living out of the tenants or trying to exploit the tenants.
Well, they were supplying something the tenants needed. And I've met lots of the tenants. And there were some landladies that they didn't like, and some landladies that they stayed with for 50 years. So I don't think that the landladies were angels in disguise. I think they were just normal people making a normal living, you know? I think it was all, a lot of it was exaggerated for the sake of a good story.
But just on that idea that the government might sell off the houses, is that still a fear or a potential threat?
I don't know. The department, as you will have gathered from the newspapers, the department has sold various houses. But I think... I feel sorry for the public servants involved because most of them are career public servants. They've never been in anything else. They don't have much idea of the real estate market. They don't have much idea of how to manage communities. And that's one of the problems that we have at the moment with the city council. That the city council thinks that it is in favour of villagers. And that's a romantic idea. And they have withdrawn the various things that were being done which were supporting villagers. So we're about to go back to, well, we've been, you know, making representations to the council about that.
Trying to maintain the status of a village?
Well, the thing is that we had worked for years and years and years. We had got to the stage where they had a liaison officer who went around to the various resident groups around the city, listening to the sorts of things that needed to be done, you know, and alerting the various departments within the council, or saying to us, look, talk to so-and-so, talk to Cobb, talk to Wayne, talk to so-and-so. And that was efficient, partly because they got to know the community and could work out the difference between a rat bag ringing up, and we have rat bags, or someone seriously saying, look, this, you know, the boughs are falling off the tree near the children's kindergarten. It needs to be pruned. You know, just simple things. Well, then someone advanced their career in the council by economising and dispensing with the idea of the community liaison officer. So it was rather galling to receive some of the council papers with city of villages on it, and you think to yourself, oh yeah? You know? When the simple things that make the communities work were taken away to advance someone's career, and then they do all the PR exercise of the city of villages, and you think to yourself, how naive.
Does it feel like a village as somebody, though, living here?
Oh, yes. You see, I'd always lived in... Now, was brought up in Pymble, not in one of the wealthy parts of Pymble. In fact, we lived opposite the pig farm when I was little, in Bridge Street. And we used to take the scraping of the plates and the peelings across the road, and the cows would come down to the fence because they liked the peelings. And the owls would sit up in the branch to get some meat scraps. So you'd put the meat scraps outside the fence and put the peelings and everything inside the fence for the cows. And every now and again we would be allowed to go in and up to see the big mother pig. Marvellous. Of course, you don't sort of... We regarded that as normal. Mind you, this is 1945 or something like that, and it's a bit different now. Mm. Where we did that, they've built a swimming pool. But when... That was... We knew all the people up and down the street. That was great. You know, we knew the man who drove the bus, and we knew when the poor girl down the road had the baby without being married, and, you know, all those things. Well, that was fine. But then when I went from... there and got married, and particularly lived at Roseville, my sister Marcia. They are very much more reserved. Now, to come here where you know people, I know so many people, and they know about us, and there's people we're really fond of, and there's some people that I don't like, but there's some people that I really admire. And there are times when we work all, you know, together.
But do you think it's viable to maintain this sense of a village when the heart of what really established Miller's Point was the waterfront-based employment?
But that hasn't been here for 15, 20 years. And I still know about 130 people.
So, but is it not inevitable that as those older people who used to work here die off, that people who don't really have a sense of identification with the place come in?
Yes. And it probably will be much... There will be fewer people who know one another. It's life.
I mean, does the history, the fact that it's a historic area, does that mean something personally to you?
Oh, yes, very much so. Goodness. You right?
Sorry.
Yes, I very much appreciate the privilege of living here. It is a privilege. It's a wonderful place to live. And, of course, we worked very hard to have it declared a heritage precinct. The whole area is now a heritage precinct. So it's protected. There was a lot of work.
What would be, just to sort of move towards wrapping up, what would be the biggest changes you have seen in the 15 years here?
The Walsh Bay development, because when I came, the wharves were falling into the water. It was terrible. It was awful to see. But it was lovely to have them there. They're sort of grand and fading. But it is good to see them retrieved and used. Because you don't want places to become echoing museums. And I agree with Philippe Robert, the French heritage architect, on that. He talks about adaptive reuse. Some of the adaptive reuse, like that awful pyramid on the Louvre, I hate. But I like the way Walsh Bay has gone. Patrick's involvement with the wharves has been a mixed blessing. The gradual increase in it being lawful is a help. It's been good.
So that you mean the reduction of crime?
Crime, yes. Mm. Yes.
And the sort of mix of public and private seems to work quite well here. You know, the mix, because it is considered a bad social thing to have only public housing, because you clump people from disadvantaged backgrounds together very often. But this sort of ad hoc thing seems to make for a healthier kind of community.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. Mm. Yes.
So just to finish, or unless there's anything else you'd like to say, what would be your hopes for Miller's Point in the future? How would you like to see it go?
Well, I think it is becoming gentrified, and that can't be escaped from. And in another 50 years, I would think it's quite likely to be more so. Purely selfishly, I would like the atmosphere and the relationships of the community to last as long as they possibly can. But that needs local people to spend the time to take the trouble to do things. Now, it means, for instance, you know, in this next 3 or 4 days, I have to finish preparing 2 flyers to letterbox drop all the people here and all through the high rise. We have to prepare a newsletter, which means I'll have to prepare a newsletter. Mars will take the photographs. We'll letterbox drop the newsletter around, particularly down on the wharves, to keep everyone reminded of what the issues are, what we need support on, what's going on. It is a lot of hard work, but well worthwhile. And, you know, it won't last forever. But while it does, it's good. It's a good thing.
Okay, Millicent, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you. I'll just put an ID down again. End of interview.